Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Kachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Kachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's kachava.com, code NEWS.
Charlotte, we were just talking about whether we each practice a kind of digital hygiene in terms of our virtual workspaces. I think of Charlotte as quite like a disciplined person, and I sort of imagine that she would have a whole like folder system. But tell me, how is the data arranged?
I'm very strict about my emails and my inbox, but when it comes to screenshots, PDFs, links, like a lot of ephemera I try to save, it's a mess. I just put it all in one folder and I often don't label things. I have a folder called taxes that's very organized, and I have a folder called writing that's very organized, and then I literally have a folder called desktop everything ! And that's the pit. That's where everything goes.
Well, I'm amazed that you're saving ephemera like that. That's quite rigorous.
Well, what's the point? It's like a bird collecting trash.
True, but you're turning like your scholarly gaze upon, you know, like you're relating to digital reality in a slightly different way. I do.
You know, what's fun is I just downloaded and started to read someone's thesis about BL, Japanese BL, boy love. And it actually opens with a Sarah Shulman quote about going to this conference on like lesbian literature in Japan and only meeting straight women. And Sarah Shulman being like, what's going on? I haven't gotten very far in the thesis, but it's really fun. It was really fun to encounter Sarah Shulman in this thesis.
It's a little essay by her about, well, it's a citing Sarah Shulman on attending this. This sounds amazing. I want to read this.
It's from 1992, Sarah Shulman, Tokyo Rose. I'll just read the part from Sarah, which opens chapter one of this 400-page thesis. I had the opportunity to visit Japan for free. The occasion was the first Tokyo Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. That night we attended the pre-opening party, which was totally straight except for one lone dyke volunteer, Hiroko Kakafuda, the first Japanese to come out on television. There's someone I want you to meet, my publisher said, the translator of Andrew Halloran. I was quite surprised when the editor introduced me to another straight woman in her 30s, chicly dressed in designer ensemble and handbag. So I don't know what else is going on after that. Isn't that funny though?
This sounds like an amazingly underappreciated and fascinating text.
Wow. I know. Sarah's had such a long career, I think, Sarah. I mean, I'm not like on a first name basis with her, but I think she's just written so prolifically for so long.
I mean, we talk about her all the time for a reason.
We do.
Because she keeps because she organically comes up. As in this case, you went researching boy love. You weren't looking for Sarah Shulman at all, but she was there.
She was there. She's all wherever the pulse is, you know.
That's beautiful. But sorry, can you say a little bit more about what you were researching?
No, because I'm writing about it. So if I say anything, it'll ruin it. Fine, you know how that works. Fine. You gotta hold it in your head, because if you talk about it too much, it just like, well, sorry. I can talk to you about something else Japanese. I read the most remarkable novel. It's called A Personal Matter by Kenzaburo Oe, who won the Nobel Prize for literature. And I want to let everyone know that the Japanese literature I have read in translation, the only type of Japanese literature I have read, I have found almost uniformly astoundingly boring. And I keep trying because it's an entire country with a long history, right? So I can't just
say, like, that's not possible, is it?
Right.
Like, that's, you're doing something wrong.
So I forget where or how I must have just, I don't know, found him because I was looking at Nobel laureates or something. And I started with his nonfiction. I read this book called Hiroshima Notes, which is all about the victims of the bombing. And it was interesting in as much as I learned from it, but I didn't find it compelling, which again could be a translation problem. Because he clearly, as a writer, was very compelled by this one doctor in particular. And he is telling very moving stories about doctors who were trying to help other victims of the bomb while they themselves were incredibly burned and they had no materials that, you know, they... So,
unimaginable.
Right. But I just... I was just kind of like, well, here I am again. It's something about Japanese literature in English translation that I just can't plug into. If I'm recalling correctly, Jessa Crispin recently mentioned on her podcast that a lot of Japanese literature was translated because soldiers had learned it by in the course of the war or because of the war or something, or like that there's some cross like pollination happening there or something. If that's incorrect, and she didn't say that, I apologize for attributing it to her, but it made sense to me. Like,
yes.
In our year in reading, I mentioned Robert Aitken, who became a Zen monk because he was interred by the Japanese during World War II, and one of the guards gave him like a book on Buddhism or something. So, you know, cultures interact during wars. They just do.
I also have a whole theory about there would never be like European modernism without the like Japonais, you know, like mega trend of the late 19th century when people became obsessed with Japanese art. And I don't think that anyone would have come up with the idea of taking away most of the things from a work of art to see what it would be like if there were only three or like one. I don't think it was within our capacity.
Totally. But, I endorse that.
But I don't think I've ever come across this idea. That's so true sounding.
It is. Yes, I agree. I agree. That's why I remembered it. And the other thing that felt true sounding to me, and my inherent bird collecting bits of trash is really coming through here in the way I'm presenting this. Please,
it's listeners, called dialectical materialism, Charlotte.
Feel
it's
free. Totally valid. Listeners can, please, I am soliciting your feedback and education and information. I saw someone on Substack say something to the effect of the translator, I have him right here, hold on. The translator, not the Substack person, unfortunately. Okay, J. Rubin, Murakami's translator. They said something to the effect of, like, he has done irreparable damage to English language translation because he set a certain style by which everyone else started.
Oh, so there's, like, an existing a tradition in English that's, like, constraining your ability to connect with Japanese literature now.
I think so. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that explains everything. And in case
infected by boomerism.
It's really interesting to me. You can look up a video of J. Rubin giving a speech in Japanese, and his spoken Japanese is atrocious, which as someone who can't speak English very well but does feel pretty comfortable reading it, I don't think that can't necessarily be held against him, but it is pretty fascinating to imagine that this, that he has a really refined understanding of Japanese as a written language, but when he speaks it, he sounds terrible. I don't know. I actually find that kind of inspiring.
It's like kind of a power play situation.
So this, A Personal Matter, this novel is translated by a man named John Nathan. And he does say that this particular author, Oe, consciously interferes with the tendency to vagueness, which is considered inherent in the Japanese language. And he said there were Japanese critics who cried that Oe's prose, quote, reeks of butter, which is a way of saying that he has alloyed the purity of Japanese with constructions from Western languages. It is true that Oe's style assaults traditional notions of what the genius of language is. This is was written in 1968, this translator note. And this novel was electrifying. I'm going to tell you all about some of the plot, but the language as well, though, was so radically removed from any Japanese translation I had read before, and so vivid. So it opens on a man who's wandering around while his wife is in labor at the hospital. He's essentially been sent away by his mother-in-law. So he's wandering around and he's buying these maps of Africa because he has a dream of going to Africa that he's had all his life, and he knows that it's unlikely to happen, especially now that he's about to be a father. He's buying these maps. He goes into an arcade. He gets into a physical fight with this group of young thugs, basically this group of delinquents that, according to the Japanese culture I've consumed, are wandering Japan at all times. They're always violent delinquents out and about looking for people to assault. He also has a run-in with like a trans prostitute. So already there's a lot happening. He keeps calling to check, is the baby delivered? Is the baby delivered? And finally they say, yeah, the baby is here and you need to hurry up and get here. And the way they say it lets him know something is wrong. So he shows up, he says, I'm the father. And the way the medical professionals are talking about the baby is pretty atrocious. So much so that the protagonist, whose name is Bird, which is a nickname, but that's what everyone calls him, guesses that the baby's dead. And they say, no, the baby is not dead, but he's essentially deformed. And it's like, come look at him. He has this massive brain hemorrhage and he's going to die soon. And it's so fast paced. It's all so unpredictable. He gets into the fight, then he goes to the hospital, and they haven't told his wife yet. She has no idea. They just took the baby away. I'm going to read you a little bit, just a little selection of Bird asking, are you a brain specialist? Oh no, I'm an obstetrician. I consider myself fortunate to have run across a case of brain hernia. I hope to be present at the autopsy. You will consent to an autopsy, won't you? It may distress you to talk about autopsies at this point, but well, look at it this way. Progress in medicine is cumulative, isn't it? And he goes on, besides, if I may be frank, I think the baby would be better off dead, and so would you and your wife. It seems to me the quicker the infant dies, the better for all concerned. I don't know about you. Maybe it's the difference in generations. I was born in 1935. How about you? Somewhere around there, Bird said, unable to convert quickly into the Western calendar. I wonder if it's suffering. What, our generation? The baby. This book is so outrageous because it is so funny. It is so dead serious and disturbing and upsetting. What, our generation? That is so funny.
I mean,
funny.
I just been like wrapped the whole time. I mean, that's very unusual sounding. Almost like pinch-ish?
Bert is always being sent away from the hospital and then told to come back. So they send him off, and he doesn't know what to do with himself. He's wandering around. He's thinking so many things about the baby and his own future. And, you know, he'll have these moments of pity for the baby, and then he'll think, like, of course, it's better if the baby dies. And he's thinking about how to handle things with his wife. He goes into a barber shop, and he says, I'll get a shave before I see my mother-in-law and my wife, and that'll be good. So he's getting shaved. He's getting cut because he moves around. The barber says, you'll want a shampoo. No, that's all right. There's lots of dirt and grass in your hair, the barber objected. I know, I fell down last night. So when he was being beaten up by the kids, he like fell down this sort of ravine or something. This is the tiniest bit of this book. The that only word funny. I can come up with is outrageous. It's so funny, and it's also incredibly disturbing because he essentially enters into an agreement with one of the doctors that they are going to try to kill this child through neglect. And it's a very, very...
Oh my
God. I know. I'm not even conveying probably like half of the book because he also manages to have an affair with this female friend of his, a very intense, transformative sexual affair, while his wife is in the dark, while they're waiting for the baby to die of neglect. This friend reveals to him that the time they had sex as college students, he raped her, which he always thought that was such a passionate, crazy night. She was a virgin.
Oh my God.
Everyone listening, please, I'm begging you to read it. I feel like I'll never forget it in my life. Meanwhile,
Sorry, can you do that thing of like reiterating the title and author so that while
it's at
the top front of everyone's mind, we can write it down?
It is called A Personal Matter by Kenzaburo Oe. I already knew going into it that he himself, the author, had a disabled son with like a brain hernia. But his son, he seems to have a lot of regard for and has written a lot about how the experience of coming to know his son changed his life. And his son was a composer. And he seems like he was a very loving father, but, and this is not to mistake a fictional character for the author. It's not to conflate them, but it does seem plausible that a lot of these thoughts, you know, pass through his mind. I'm sure that's what gives them a lot of the power they have. He will think remarkably compassionate, devastatingly sweet things, like when this horrible little obstetrician is nervously laughing about how the baby is going to die and he wants to do the autopsy. He's thinking, poor baby, this was the first person the baby met. You know? I know. I feel like it is a singular reading experience. I don't think I've ever read anything at all like this book.
Do you think it's like specifically, trying to, you know, say the unsayable parts that it poses a pretty interesting question to fiction, doesn't it? And it makes me think of like Hermann Hesse or like, you know, just novels like The Tin Drum or like Steppenwolf I guess Pynchon is the thing I was thinking of before, of suspending reality in order to use to use dreamlike logic to address the unsayable or like the unshared or the things that but this sounds like, so this is pretty, it's set in reality as it were.
Yeah, it seems totally realistic, especially the conflicting indications from medical professionals that in that moment you would be reliant on a medical professional to help you and also to guide you. And the the book is definitely concerned with the question of once you decide you are willing to extinguish a life through neglect, intentional neglect, where do you begin to draw the line? Once you decide you do not want this life to continue, does that mean you won't suffocate the baby? Because he has to keep affirming the decision. He has to keep recommitting to the decision. And again, I'm leaving out so much. He also has this job teaching at a cram school, and he gets so wasted that he throws up on all fours in front of the whole class.
It's like a cavalcade of nightmares.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate.
Did you ever read Terminal Boredom by Izumi?
No, but I feel like maybe you mentioned it before. Maybe you told me to, or you just, that feels very familiar to me.
I think I may have. It was translated by Daniel Joseph. He translated it. And it's so good. It's this, I feel like I have told you about it, but yeah, it's set in this world where men are like illegal. It's like a kind of dictatorship of women, and told from the perspective of a girl. Well, I guess that's just like one of the stories. It's a collection of stories that sort of, yeah, playful but very nightmarish. And I don't know, I kind of want to, I'm trying to look up when it was actually published. 1984, translated in 2021. I think that this story collection would complement this amazing A Personal Matter. Sounds so good.
Do you ever have the experience of reading a novel that's so good that you just think it renews your entire perspective on the whole of literature? Or like the human project of art making?
I feel like I can't tell if you're laughing at yourself as in the like absurdity of the statement, or at the like the joy of art making.
Both I think both. That you just, that it redeems, this one novel has single-handedly redeemed every effort by every human being alive ever.
No, 100%, 100%. I can specifically remember moments of reading novels and then being like, oh, I get it. Like, what novels are for. Why people love them. I think I had that. Maybe with Jane Austen. I mean, these are really, like, nerdy, stupid ones, I think, to choose.
No,
but, like, they're
not
ones
stupid.
That really, like...
Have you been reading anything lately?
Yeah. I've been reading a few things. There is a new collection, the first ever full one, of the stories that Langston Hughes translated into English from Mexico and Cuba. These stories are just, oh my God, like it can really translate. Like, let me find, they're mostly, stories that are pretty short. Writers include Juan de la Cabada, Rafael Felipe Munoz, some really amazing writers. There's a lot about a lot of stuff set in the countryside, a lot of stuff about like revolutionaries, just like, or like vistas and people traveling around the countryside, like dealing with the cold, like, oh, my horse fell on a hole. Literally, that's the first story, is involves a horse falling in a hole,
which is tragic.
Oh my God, maybe I'll just leave. Okay. So, the horse is sinking in a hole. The owner of the hole. This story is by Rafael Felipe Munoz, and it's called Gold Horse and Man, and translated by Langston Hughes. So the horse is in the hole. Five ropes whizzed simultaneously through the air with a single whistle, but due to bad judgment, or else that the ones who threw them had but little desire to see themselves in danger as well. All fell short as Fierro, who's the owner of the horse, without dropping his gold, tried to grab at the ropes with his right hand. This made him lose his balance and he fell in the water. He came up entirely covered with slime, waving his arms, now free of their heavy burdens. His face had lost nearly all human semblance. He wanted to say something, but half smothered by the mud in his mouth, he only succeeded in giving forth a guttural yell like an orangutan in the jungle. A few moments later, he began to sink slowly. He dropped his arms and stood with only his head up, yelling. The Vistas pulled in their ropes quickly and threw them out anew, but once more they fell short. Soon Fierro's head was level with the water, and then it too went down. His arms came up, holding the snakeskin belt full of gold as his last offering for salvation. He's trying to, like, pay someone to save him, basically. Then everything disappeared beneath the water that once more took on the aspect of a smoky glass, without waves, hardly rippled by the wind. That just, like, absolutely killed me. This image of someone slowly, slowly sinking in the mud, trying to buy assistance.
It's sort of so cartoony. Can't you see that animated so easily?
I guess all literature of revolution involves, like, escape, hiding, the landscape, a lot of trains. But yeah, I haven't finished it, but so far I'm just, like, really, really enjoying. I'm excited to try and look up in Spanish. They're, like, originals. I'm sure this is, like, in canonical shit that, like, everybody has read, but, like, I'm just really excited to keep pursuing. And my admiration for Langston Hughes' translation is, like, beyond. Like, he would really do it.
Well, everybody definitely hasn't read them, so you shouldn't worry about that. But was Langston Hughes writing these? Were they commissions? Were they being published in a magazine or something?
So, I'm pretty sure that his father was working in, like, in Mexico, and when his father reappeared in his life, he was like, I want to spend time with you, and so went to Mexico with him. And then he essentially explains that, like, the politics of the people he met and the writers that he came across were okay. Let me see. This is from the jacket. These stories, as he wrote to a friend, explore, quote, the revolutions and uprisings, sugarcane, Negroes, Indians, corrupt generals, American imperialists, and are mostly all left stories, because practically all the writers down here are left these days. That's just, like, his brief, basically, like, description of the scene and the politics. So it seems like they were, like, for contemporary, not really publication. Like, some of them were published in magazines of the time, but it seemed like his own project. Yeah. But I think, I don't know Langston Hughes's, like, calendar well enough to know what is, like, from before or after his, like, experiences in Mexico, but highly recommend Troubled Lands, Stories of Mexico and Cuba, as translated by Langston Hughes. Edited and introduced by Ricardo A. Wilson II, who's a professor at Williams. Great book.
We are joined today by Nicholas Russell, who is a writer and critic from Las Vegas. His work has been featured in McSweeney's, The Baffler, Conjunctions, The Nation, and Orion, among other publications. He's a longtime bookseller, a contributing writer at Defector, and managing editor at Still Alive magazine. His debut novel, Observer, will be published by Eco at HarperCollins on September 15th of this year, 2026. Welcome, Nicholas!
Hi, guys. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm really excited to have you.
Just, like, thank you for bringing us exclusive information.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone loves an exclusive. Congratulations on getting a September pub date for this much-anticipated novel.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, thank you. I'm excited. Horror in September.
Well, what book are you here to talk about?
I'm going
to
do what other guests have done before, which is to, like, talk about the things I was going to talk about. And then get to the thing I was going to talk about.
You reflecting us back at this, like, this is incredibly satisfying to me to feel heard in this way.
So the first thing I was thinking of was this book called The Natural History of Hell, which is a short story collection by this writer named Jeffrey Ford. And He is mostly a short fiction writer, and I've read all of his work. Like, he's really great, and he's still around. I'm like hoping he has like something new in the near future because I really like him. And then it wasn't quite what I was feeling, and so I was thinking maybe Lisa Tuttle, who people might know because NYRB reissued a novella of hers called My Death. This is like 2 years ago or something. And she's really interesting because first of all, she's a writer I always thought was British. She's American. She moved to England, though. So I think maybe some sensibility got in there. She is a writer who was known for a very long time in speculative fiction circles. She wrote a lot of sci-fi and fantasy. If I'm remembering correctly, this could be totally wrong, but I'm pretty sure she was for a long time in a relationship with George R. R. Martin, and they like wrote a book together. And this was like in the 70s or 80s. But a lot of her fiction is about like relationships and like heterosexuality, in which the uncanny or something very like inexplicable happens, like either because of or within the relationship. My Death is sort of about that, but she has this collection called Riding the Nightmare, which is a great title, which is crazy. Like, some of the wildest stories I've like ever read.
I'm so sorry. Riding like a horse or writing with a pen?
Riding.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's way better.
Riding the Nightmare, yeah.
Oh, fuck yeah.
There's like a whole... That story specifically is...
That's confidence crazy. In your artistry.
Every time I read one of her stories, it's like I'm left with this wonder of like what she must be like to talk to, because it's they're very uncomfortable, very unsettling, very emotionally provocative, in a stunt kind of way, but she just like talks about things that are very the things you talk about with like your friends like in a corner somewhere, and like those are what the stories are about. Very ugly feelings that are explored in such really interesting ways. And then going off of that, I was thinking of, okay, maybe I'll talk about Robert Aikman, who wrote another...
Compulsory Games,
who is like, exactly, he also writes about, I feel like, relationships and the uncanny, and he has this really interesting idea of like the ghost story as a repository for not necessarily horror, but like a sort of like slippage in like reality. And yeah, Compulsory Games, like that collection is just full of such incredibly strange, hard to categorize stories that are kind of horror, kind of gothic, but they don't quite go where you think they're going to go.
They're incredibly prosaic and freaky in some ways.
Yeah.
Have we talked about him before,
Nicholas? He came up in our episode with Sarah Miller on the Castlereagh Chronicles.
Mm.
We haven't like properly kind of...
He hasn't,
you know,
we haven't processed him. No. Okay.
He's...
Fucking love.
He's awesome. Bobby. Yeah. But then I was like, okay, not these three people. Sorry to lead you on a little grand journey there. But then I was like, okay, I want to talk about someone... Because I'm in like a short story mode lately, and I have been in a gothic sort of frame of mind for a while now. So then I was like, okay, I want to talk about Algernon Blackwood, who is a writer that if you've ever like gotten a anthology of chilling supernatural tales or gothic, you know, stories or ghost stories or any of these like, you know, reframed like public domain like collections of stories, he will be in there, and it'll either be a story called The Willows or a story called The Wendigo. He was this British author born in like late 1860s who was the son of an evangelical, like, born-again Christian preacher, and was not very good in school, was, like, sent to a lot of boarding schools, sort of, like, washed out of all of them, like, to the chagrin of his parents, and then eventually he left England when he was like 21, I want to say, and went to America and spent the next 9 years in Canada and the United States. And after that, came back and started writing these like ghost stories, supernatural, like horror stories. And he's very interesting because he has a sensibility that feels at once very British, but also there's a lot of about nature, and specifically what reads to me a lot of the time as like an American sort of landscape. And he had this very interesting idea of capital N nature as like a living force, as like the universe is sentient in all these ways that we don't understand. And that's where a lot of the horror of his stories comes from, is it's kind of cosmic, but it's not on the like sort of broad level of Lovecraft, wherein it's like something from not this world. The entities you encounter are things of this world that people just don't know about. But he's a really interesting guy. And because he's been anthologized so much, and because his stories and his work has been like republished in all these different permutations, it's kind of hard to be like, okay, this is the book. But I have an Oxford Classics edition called The Wendigo and Other Stories. That is where I'm going to draw from. So Algernon Blackwood and The Wendigo is what I'm going with.
I feel like I have read The Wendigo, but maybe not. Maybe I've just heard of it.
It's very famous.
What is the premise of that?
So, like a lot of Algernon Blackwood stories, it takes place on a canoe trip. There's a lot of him, like, he also, like, loved the Alps, so he was, like, always in Switzerland. Like, he was, like, a very, like, kind of, like, English guy, loves to out there, like, getting it, right? And, like, loved hiking and sort of being out in nature. And so, you know, the Wendigo is interesting to me because it is a story of, like, a fear of hybridity. So the Wendigo is like an indigenous myth, or like a creature that, depending on your sort of what you're trying to do with your version of it, can mean a lot of different things, but essentially is like a person who turns into this like very violent creature for a variety of different reasons. Like, could be like, in the more sort of like westernized sort of version, it's like a sort of like an allegory for sin, or like being like contaminated in some way. And in Algernon Blackwood's version, it's like, you know, there's this party that's being guided by this person who like is of some sort of mixed race, and is not trusted sort of because of this. And like, there's this sort of running, it's not the point of the story, but there's a sort of tangent that gets re-upped every now and then of the suspicions of different people in the party based off of like where they're from and like who they know and how long they've been in the area. And mm-hmm. like, and the Wendigo is this thing that's like picking people off, and, you know, is a force that is very primal, and I guess in Algernon Blackwood's terms would probably be like primitive or something, you know, like quite can be reasoned with. And then like the Willows is another one where it's like sort of tree based horror. he wrote a lot about trees and the things that trees could do. He has a story called The Man Whom the Trees Loved. That's really weird, and it's not technically horror, but is more like fantasy.
What did the trees love about him?
He's someone who is sort of embraces, which way Western man kind of thing. Like, he kind of rejects modernity, or not modernity, that's like the wrong word, but like, you know, he rejects the sort of arrow of time, and like immerses himself in a kind of nature that is is not recreational, I guess you could say. It's not like, oh, where I love to hike and stuff, you know.
Where is it set?
The Man Who the Tree is Loved, I think, is in England.
Right. There's very, like, what's the word for, like, tree-related? I don't know. But, like, yeah, trees and, like, this animism thing. It's this very kind of, like, close to, you know, sort of, like, European romanticism.
Yeah, totally.
It's really close to fascism. Yeah. But there's really interesting reinterpretations of it, you know, that are actually way more ambivalent and, like, set in the colonies. Like, there's this one novel called The Green Man, who I can't remember the name of, but it's set in Australia. It involves this these strange encounters, yeah, with like the idea of this kind of wild that exists everywhere. And
yeah,
this sounds absolutely fascinating. I've heard of the Wendigo, and I've only read about the Wendigo as a concept, because I know it was like a lot to do with one of the things that poured into the ravenous British, like, European imagination for cannibalism, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
One of the widely cited of the, like, we've heard about this crazy thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And what's racial, like, panoply.
Well, what's interesting, I think, about Algernon Blackwood is, like, he reminds me of Herman Melville a lot, in the sense of, like, reckoning with a sort of received narrative of the rest of the world, and then, like, firsthand encounters of these places and people, and sort of trying to at once give an accurate as possible for this kind of person depiction of a place or a person that you're not familiar with, while also clearly being fascinated by, like, the exotic aspect of them. And, like, and I think the sort of racialized sort of elements are really interesting to me, because they are, they reflect these very strange anxieties about purity, but also, like, this, maybe I'm giving Algernon Blackwood too much credit, but, like, sometimes I get the sense in his fiction that he's sort of characters, I guess, maybe not him, characters are questioning the purity of their thoughts, the purity of the land around them, the purity of people's intentions, and it dictates how they react to the sort of supernatural element of the story. And I don't know, it's really interesting to me.
God, I love, like, a river story.
Yeah.
Kayak,
great river
canoe
stories. Yeah.
What do you find most interesting about him to you right now?
I think at first it was a genre consideration. Sort of like, I wanted to read Gothic literature that wasn't necessarily like canonical. I think he is technically canonical because he literally is, like, anthologized a lot, but, you know, is not really brought up in the same breath as a lot of the sort of more obvious people. And because he also gets lumped in with this sort of, like, quote, weird fiction or whatever, right? Which is, like, next door to, like, Lovecraftian horror, right? It's not quite a monster, and it's not quite things jumping out at you. It's more of, there's a lot that has to do with characters' perception or mental state, and the degree to which they can, like, understand reality versus something that is, like, a delusion or hallucination. He has this really, he had really good story titles. He has a really great story called The Man Who Found Out. And just so you know, you never find out what he found out, which is awesome. And it's about, like, this guy who is, like, an apprentice for this, I guess he's, like, a professor. He's, like, a scientist of some sort. And they've been working on this, like, sort of grand theory of the world. Not, like, on, not, it's very vague. You don't really know what kind of scientist they are. But you know they're a scientist because there's, like, vials and stuff around. And they have, like, a lab. But you're not, like, really sure what's in it. And the story is really short, and it sort of takes place when the professor or like elder scientist goes out and is like, we're so close to to having an answer for like what it's all for like what the meaning of life is. And he's gone for like a year and comes back and writes, he has like written it, all his findings down. And his like apprentice or whatever is like, so did you learn what you needed to? And he's like, come into my study. And he tells him and shows him and is like, when I die, you can read what I found. And then you have to burn everything that we've worked on. And of course, like soon after, the like elder guy dies and his pupil's like, oh, this is ridiculous. Like, come on, like we got to know. And so he reads and goes into this like frenzied state where he like destroys everything because he's so upset by what he learns. And he calls a friend who's a hypnotist to hypnotize him so he forgets like everything he read from like the last hour. And that's like the end of the story. So you don't ever find out what it is. You don't know what it even concerns you. It's all about the fact that like these people react in this like extremely like visceral way to what you're led to believe is like a definitive answer for like existence or whatever. And like I think the way it's told is part of what's so awesome about it, is that he somehow makes it so that you actually stop caring about specifically what they're learning and you're more interested in just like how they're encountering it. And there's something about that that I think is such a great magic trick of like this huge premise in terms of like the answers to the world or whatever, but like focusing in on like people's behavior and like the character at like reacting to a thing that you made up and like and having it feel so gripping. And it's like a formal thing too, because it's a really short story and they're like on the page, like in terms of detail, there's like not really that much there, but it really works.
It's cool to me to think about it as something a little bit out of its time. I mean, I know, mm-hmm. I know that there are a lot of like, you know, types of spooky stories that play with fear, I guess, mm-hmm. in the sort of like turn of the, let's say like decline of the British Empire or something, let's say, like, until it switches to space, right? Mm-hmm. And like, because remind me most the way you're describing them of maybe like Isaac Asimov stories, totally. Or things that, or Arthur C. Clarke, like these parables involving life and death and meaning. And it just kind of strikes me like, you know, if he'd been born 40 years later, maybe he would have been writing stories that then like great early sci-fi movies would be based on. You know, right. What I mean?
Yeah. So I want to read just a little bit of his idea of like nature that I think is like fascinating. So it might not surprise you, in given like where he's situated in history, he was like he was part of this thing called the Order of the Golden Dawn, which is like,
that's famous. That's very famous.
Yeah. They're like, what do you call them? Rosicrucians or whatever. Like basically they're like that, but,
they have their own tarot, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah,
they're legitimate.
He had this, let's see. By far the strongest influence in my life, however, was nature, capitalized nature. It betrayed itself early, growing in intensity with every year, bringing comfort, companionship, inspiration, joy. The spell of nature has remained dominant, a truly magical spell. The early feeling that everything was alive, a dim sense that some kind of consciousness struggled through every form, even that a sort of inarticulate communion with, quote, this other life was possible. These moods colored its opening wonder. Nature, at any rate, produced effects in me that only something living could produce, which is interesting because I'm like, isn't nature living? Only something living could produce. Is that, but yeah, it's like, that's like sort of all of his stories, even the ones that aren't like about nature or whatever, are like, are driven by this idea of like the ineffable consciousness or sentience of things. He's like both afraid of it and compelled by it. And that sort of feels true to me as like a thing to write about, you know?
But does it feel more than a construct? Like, you know, more than just a place where he's pouring his, I don't know, otherwise undigested libidinal. I don't know. I mean, I feel like you most often read about, at least these days, you know, about like nature, capital N, or something. Mm-hmm. A concept that we can critique, you know.
Right, but, right.
It kind of means everything. But that's also just something I do think is interesting, that it's something that encapsulates so much. So it sounds like he actually has an incredibly specific idea in mind.
Yeah, I feel like...
a consciousness.
Yeah, a consciousness or...
animism? So there's,
animism, I think, is like a good way of thinking of it. Because it's not... as far as I understand, because I would love to read a biography about him. It's like, it's not a god or anything. You know, it's not like a single entity. It's a sort of network, makes me think of roots and trees. But like, it's sort of like a variegated kind of sentience that's like in everything. And there are like gradations in terms of like, how that sentience like bears out or can be seen or encountered. There's another story of his that I can't remember the title, but it's like about like a pit that has like a gigantic face in it. Oh, anyway, so like there's like there are like varying levels of him sort of personifying nature or like, you know, like encountering something that either is or is not anthropomorphic. And I think the reason why I like him is that so often it's not a thing that looks like a person. The Wendigo is sort of like the outlier because like it is a person shaped creature, but everything else is usually like the horror is like the wind sounds really weird or like, or yeah. Was that tree like that close before? I don't think it was. It's like, it's that kind of thing, you know, like. Sort of like nature is like, if you are in the wrong place at the wrong time or right place at the right time, like something is activated that like makes it so that you are like enclosed by a sort of dimension of reality that is otherwise like been pushed away by like cities or whatever, you know?
And it makes me think of our conversation with Tori about plant sentience. And I think there was a moment where Tori said, oh, but this book convinced me plants are alive. And then she kind of laughed and like corrected herself. And she's like, I mean sentient. But it's like, no, there's a way in which we know organic things are alive. But we're also like, they're not alive the way we're alive. But it feels different to me than what you're describing, which I feel like I have encountered before as a notion and fiction, which, like you said, it's not God. It's not a Christian, like Judeo-Christian idea of God or something, because it's more diffuse than that. But it's like an intelligence that can have an intention that we can't locate anywhere and never will be able to locate. But it's all around us. And that is unnerving. You know, that at any moment it could take an interest in us. Even though maybe like we can, you know, sometimes we can just do our thing and like it doesn't really care.
Yeah, but it'll then, like respond to you. I think that's another thing, right? It's like that's what's maybe scary. Yeah, yeah. It's like you're encountering something that you think doesn't have the ability to react to you, like, and it does, and it makes you react in turn. It reminds me too of like what Annie Dillard is getting at in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which is like being immersed in nature and quickly losing or maybe like dislocating your sense of primacy over your environment and sort of this equalizing that can kind of happen where you are not operating under this like illusion that you can do anything and will be fine in any environment, but that like there are, if not rules, then, you know, it's almost like a different kind of gravity is like applying to you, and you have to reorient yourself in order to like survive almost. I mean, he does have stories that are straightforward, just like, what if this happened and it's scary? And you're like, yeah, totally. But
but I feel like it sounds kind of like it's the, right, like there's something witnessing you that and you thought you were alone. It makes, I don't know, the man who was loved by trees, which is such a like hilarious grammatical like inflection. But that idea of being seen, praised, judged, rightly or wrongly, in a again, it's kind of like in a, according to some system that's definitely not like Christian morality.
It's interesting. So like in the intro to this Oxford edition, there, the writer, who is a guy named Aaron Wirth, who's a professor at Boston University, he talks about how Algernon Blackwood like really rejected the sort of evangelical Christianity that his father was sort of, you know, a disciple of, and located his spiritual or religious interest in, like, Joe, what you're saying, this sort of animism. And I think, you know, the Order of the Golden Dawn is, depending on how you look at it, is either like kind of the ultimate parody of this sort of like society of guys who are like into some crazy shit that like only like commoners could dream of, right? But I think for him it represents a kind of, I don't know, it made me think of like Tolkien, kind of, in that like so much of Tolkien's writing, not just his fiction, is like shaped by his experience in war and like his Catholicism and like holding on to or having your understanding of religion reframed by a traumatic experience or like an experience that the entire world has like been caught up in. And Algernon Blackwood, as someone who is like very interested and defensive of like the British Empire, there's something about like a kind of last gasp that I think animates his work as well. I don't know. He also wrote nonfiction. I'm just like really not versed in like what it was about. That, though, I will say the only autobiography he ever wrote was about his time in America when he was like 21. Because he was like, it was like an incredibly difficult time for him, like both like materially, like he didn't have a lot of money and was, and just met a lot of like really scary people or whatever, and like was kind of, he talks about it as like the event of his life, like these 9 years that he was in America.
Sounds like you, Joe.
Literally, I'm in it right now. I'm fucking terrified.
Well, it's just like, and he wrote it like when he was like old, so it's like he was thinking about it for like his entire life, being like, America, that's fucked so me up.
It probably got scarier with time.
And God, that's where like the wellspring of his stories come from too, is from his time in America.
Yeah, when you were just saying that about like America, danger, fear. Do you think that this kind of work has suffered by getting kind of lumped in with other stuff? Like, I don't know, Arthur Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, this sort of like very, not middle brow so much as like very TV adaptation.
Sure.
Style. You know what I mean? Like it's difficult to really, doesn't really have an equivalent.
This is sort of like a flavor of this. And his is so specific that it's like, I would hope that people who read him are like, what the hell is this dude's deal? Like, and like seek out more by him. Cause he does, the work speaks for itself, I guess is what I would say.
Writers is hosted and produced by Joe Livingstone and Charlotte Shane, and released in partnership with Book Forum Magazine. You can learn more about us and support the show at www.patreon.com/readingwriters. You can also write to us at readingwriterspod@gmail.com with questions, comments, and praise, or leave a review for us wherever you listen.
Profound thanks also to Marty Zolko and Joe Valley, who composed the beautiful music you're listening to now.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor, crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans, with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.